This is the Tribe Tech Podcast.
Hello, and it's our first chance to say Happy New Year.
Yes, welcome to 2021. Tribe Tech is back with you as we enter, we hope, the year where things get back to what we used to call normal.
Yeah, two guests in this episode. In a short while, we'll hear how the social media giants have adapted during COVID and what you need to do to make sure your business is being seen online.
But first, not much news has broken through over the past few months as coronavirus still dominates everyone's lives.
But one thing that did make all of us here in the Southwest scroll down the page was the announcement that June's G7 event will be held in Cornwall.
Yep, the leaders of the US, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the UK and a bunch of others will make their way to Carbis Bay for their annual meeting. That's President Biden, Trudeau, Macron, Chancellor Merkel, Prime Minister Suga and Conte and Johnson all dipping their toes in St Ives Sea.
It's obviously a huge moment for the county and its businesses, including the tech sector. I asked Glenn Kaplan-Gray, who's the CEO of the Cornwall and Isles of Scilly Lep, how it came about.
G7, in terms of coming to Cornwall, has come about with a recognition that some of the things that Cornwall has been grappling with for some years, some of the challenges that Cornwall has faced, are reflective of the world's challenges. You know, we have been conscious of climate change. We're one of the first regions to declare a climate emergency in the UK. We were the location of the UK's first commercial wind farm 30 years ago. So I think it is about the world catching up with Cornwall and the world catching up with the conversation that's been happening in Cornwall, which is about the importance of the environment, how you weigh that against the economy, and how you, in the long term, change the economy to become much more carbon neutral. So I think in terms of the decision making in government, who knows how these decisions are made and what the alternatives might have been. But given the agenda, I think that Cornwall's the perfect place to be having a G7 conversation about how do we build back better, to use the government's phrase, and how do we build back in a way that challenges and tackles some of the impacts of COVID, but also accelerates some of the long-term trends that we need to address, such as climate change.
So you think that was a conscious pitch then, was it, to actually say to government all of the challenges that you're looking at dealing with, Cornwall is too, and we're actually a little bit ahead of the curve on lots of these things?
Yeah, well, we, from a local enterprise partnership point of view, we started the year by publishing our local industrial strategy. So setting out a vision for Cornwall for the next 10, 20 years. And the detail of that was all about environmental sciences, geo-resources, the government's levelling up agenda, which is something else that we've been trying to tackle in Cornwall and Scilly for some time. So I think it is about the challenges that cut at the heart of everything that those G7 governments will be tackling in their own countries. There will be regions like Cornwall and Scilly in all of those countries, you know, regions that have been post-industrial, that have been viewed as peripheral or rural in the past. But as we move to an era of renewable technology where you can work from anywhere because of the rollout of superfast broadband, like in Cornwall, the opportunities for those regions to catch up and potentially overtake what has been quite an urban focus in UK and Western politics over the past 10, 20, 50 years, is a real opportunity. So I like to think that it's about how the world can learn from Cornwall, as much as Cornwall is just a fantastic place to come together and have a conversation and experience great food and environment. It's probably a mixture of both of those things.
Do you know what opportunity that the county will have to engage with leaders and their advisors during the time that we're here, so it isn't just a location that they come to for a meeting?
It's really early stages in the planning at the moment, but if you look at what has happened in previous G7 meetings and countries and regions, there has been an opportunity for not only the leaders to experience a little bit of the local culture, to understand the local economy and the local people a bit better, but there's also a big entourage that comes as well. So for us in our planning for the legacy of G7, and we do want there to be a very real, very lasting legacy, we're thinking about the run-up to the event. So, you know, it's been announced that the event will be at Carbis Bay, but there'll also be a media centre that's in Falmouth. So what we will hopefully get is thousands of the world's media arriving, looking at Cornwall, we hope, in a new light. So for us, one of those legacies will be changing the narrative about Cornwall. Cornwall is and always has been a fantastic tourism destination. It has fantastic food, fantastic drink, and a fantastic environment. And for the period of the G7 and when the world's media are here, that will speak for itself. We'll see fantastic shots of the coast. We'll see fantastic shots of the countryside. But I think it's really important that we try and talk about a whole different set of narratives as well, and what Cornwall is about now, and what, you know, locally we know Cornwall is about now, but what Cornwall can be in the future. So the LEP, for example, has been investing this year in things like a lithium pilot production plant at United Downs, building on the geothermal well. And that's because there's going to be a huge global opportunity to power electric vehicles using lithium. We've been investing in the space sector, particularly Goon Hilly, particularly Spaceport Cornwall. And we've seen recently, you know, our partners in that, Virgin Orbit, launching their first satellites in the last couple of weeks. So we want to change the narrative. We want investors, governments to view Cornwall in a different way, to make sure that we're realising the investment opportunities of the future, not just building on our tourism industry.
So how can those small businesses, and particularly, obviously, for the purposes of this conversation, those smaller tech companies, how can they make sure that they take advantage of this opportunity, and that their products and that their services and that their creativity and innovation is seen and heard?
Well, I think we've all got a responsibility to make sure that those opportunities are realised. From a local enterprise point of view, we want to be having conversations with DIT. We want to be working with government to understand how we can showcase those opportunities. And I think that will be a mix of things. It will be making sure that when the world's media here, we introduce them, both in a kind of sectoral sense, and what I've just been talking about in terms of some of the themes, but also in a very real sense. We're hopeful that, you know, COVID permitting, we'll be able to take delegations from G7 countries, the media around Cornwall, to meet people, to meet business. We're also hopeful that we will be able to produce some collateral for people to take away about the type of business opportunities that are available here, whether that be investment in big sectors or export of knowledge and skills and product. Cornwall's got a really great history of exporting knowledge and goods around the world, so it's an opportunity to sort of refocus on that. We've seen, you know, as you know, we've seen the growth of tech industries in Cornwall, huge amount over the past 5 years. So I think it's part of changing that narrative, but partly introducing the world to those businesses in a very real sense, not in just a kind of abstract way.
It's reasonable to say, then, isn't it, that this is one of the most important opportunities for Cornwall for decades?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what has happened in previous G7 meetings, as I say, it's about the leaders turning up and having the big conversations, but it's also about the entourages. We will have ambassadors here. We will have the world's media. We will have potentially trade delegations. So the G7 meeting is a lot broader. And that will be, of course, a great boost to a tourism industry and a food and drink industry that's been hugely affected. And we'll see an immediate boost because of that, with hotel rooms, the visitor economy hopefully kicking into gear at that time of year. But there's also a much longer legacy. It's the legacy of introductions that are made to businesses. It's the legacy of having those images of business opportunities spread around the world that we hope will be a much longer legacy, not just everyone comes to Cornwall and has a nice time, as they surely will, for those few days.
How do you make sure then that when Air Force One lifts up from Carbis Bay and we all wave President Biden goodbye, how do you make sure that legacy and those opportunities and no doubt the fantastic time and view of that people would have had of the county, how do you make sure that they don't float away, as it were, as all the leaders and entourages go? What will you actually be hoping that they do and the action and activity they take after they've left?
Well, I think there's two answers to that. And one is, as I say, about opportunity and changing narrative and showcasing all of those opportunities, whether it be investment in a tech startup, whether it be export of food and drink or something else. And they will be hopefully long-term relationships that are built during that period. But it's also about not ignoring the challenges. So, you know, I started by saying Cornwall's been having this conversation about the balance between the environment and the economy for some time. And that's right. But it's also been having a conversation about the reason that for the last 20 years, Cornwall and Scilly have been receiving large amounts of EU and government funding. And that's because the economy's lagging behind. So I think we've got to do two things at the same time. We've got to change the narrative and realise the opportunity to showcase a different set of industries, to showcase a different set of opportunities and skills. But we've got to do that in a way which doesn't just paper over the cracks and the issues that we're facing as a society and as an economy. And we know that those issues still exist when we look at things like the index of multiple deprivation. We look at levels of fuel poverty and levels of average wages in the region. And we need to take the opportunity to have that conversation with our own government as well, as we leave the EU and 20 years of high levels of EU investment through European Social Fund, European Regional Development Funds come to an end. And we start the next part of the journey, hopefully through what government call shared prosperity funding. We need to make sure that we're designing that in a way that accelerates those opportunities, but doesn't neglect those people that are left behind. So I think there's two parts to the conversation that we can't entirely divorce. And at one sense, they look like two conversations, but they're really not. They're about building back better. They're about transition to a different type of economy. And they're about greater levels of social inclusion and aspiration and skills development.
There's a wonderful sense of ambition and optimism that comes through when you're talking about this, which is, I think, really, really exciting for so many people. From a personal viewpoint for you, how personally excited and nervous are you about the opportunity that this presents?
I'm really excited. I think it's a great opportunity. I think, you know, you've described some of the images that we might see, but, you know, President Biden, Air Force One arriving at Newquay Airport. We don't know if that's going to happen and how his travel arrangements going to work, of course, but the mind does kind of wander to some of those images that we might see beaming around the world. And those images might include, you know, some of our renewable energy technology, thinking about, you know, companies that are doing really interesting things like Bennamon in the agricultural sector, Cornish Lithium, we've already talked about. Eden are just about to start, hopefully in the next few months, a geothermal drill on their site. So there's some great images. And I think the challenge that we've got is to curate those images and to make them as powerful as we possibly can. But I'm not nervous. I think that was the word you used, wasn't it, Robert?
Yes. Yeah, I think
yeah, I, th- no, I think I'm not
I,
th- nervous.
I think a lot of people would certainly feel that an opportunity coming along like this, that you just want to make sure that Cornwall presents itself in the best possible way because of the challenges and opportunities that you've pointed out. The long term impact of this could be huge, and you want to make sure that you grab that.
I think it'll be a lot of hard work. I think we need to think really hard about legacy, work really hard to make that happen, and to showcase the best of Cornwall. But, you know, Cornwall has a history of trade across the world. Cornwall has a history of welcoming people to our own shores as part of the tourism industry, just generally. I like to think that's part of our kind of culture and value. So I think, you know, looking outward, welcoming people is in our DNA. So I'm not nervous about it in that sense, although clearly we'll be working really hard to make it as positive as we can without losing track, as I say, of some of those challenges and some of those fault lines that run through our economy and some of the challenges we have. Really important to get the messaging right, but it's really important to also have a real conversation about the future of the economy.
That was a great interview. Sorry I couldn't be there. What was the takeaway for you from that?
I think, as Glenn said, the challenge is going to be the two Cornwalls that so many of us know about. There's, well, I say actually two, there's probably more than that. There's the tourism, agriculture, cream teas and pasties and beaches Cornwall. There's the tech Cornwall, the modern Cornwall. And this coupled with
the poverty-stricken Cornwall.
Bad areas of deprivation, exactly, yes. And there's a message that you need to get across domestically, but also a picture that you want to paint to you know, all these huge countries, individuals and potential investors coming in. And that's pretty difficult to manage, but what an opportunity.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. And I think also it's something that will bleed into other areas of the Southwest. And hopefully this is not just a big thing for Cornwall, but also a big thing for the wider region.
Yep.
So did you know that half of people under 35 use voice commands to search the internet?
Yes, because I researched that and I wrote that in.
So why does that matter?
Well, because it's just one of the main trends that have changed over the past few months and years. And it means, for example, that companies who pay for natural language promotion do better than old-fashioned keyword searches. That's the kind of thing that you need to know.
Yeah. And global marketing spend on search engines alone hit $150 billion last year. That's forecast to increase 10% this year because COVID's continuing, and that's how we're working nowadays. We spoke to one of the UK's leading social media marketeers about this.
Yep. Phil Byrne of Positive Sparks, who works closely with Google to help them understand how their own search software works. He's based here in the Southwest, and he told us how to get algorithms on social media working for you.
Social media is now at such a sophisticated point that we can reach our audience in a way that we're not able to do on Google, which has been around the longest in the modern digital age. And so if we take a very simple business, like say a local plumber, I would actually say now that they're better off creating a Facebook page than they are a website. And that's because they can reach their community, they can chat with their community, they can do things, they can update it and put content on there lots easier than most everyday people who are non-digital can do on their own website. And, you know, the thing we have with websites is we have to get traffic there. So they exist, but if we don't send traffic to them, they're not findable. Whereas a Facebook page, an Instagram page, anything which is socially driven is different. That will find people local to it. It'll get recommended by people. We have that personal element that comes into it. And that to me is, that's kind of how I see social media as a business tool. It's different if it's a cause-driven campaign you're running, or if it's someone promoting their own art or poetry for their own love. It can be great there too, but it's in a commercial sense. It's a great way to reach your audience and be right there with them so they can chat with you.
So what you're saying is that in this day and age, having a website is just not enough. You need to have a social media presence and not just one channel, but a few channels to reach the people that you want to reach.
Yeah, absolutely. And really, they come together, as you said. So your website is there almost as a brochure online or a store where people can buy things. And social media is where the conversation takes place. It's probably also the best place to build your brand. Because all of that, your brand values, why you're in business, the passions that have inspired you to create a business, come across way better on social media than they do on a website. They often tend to be a hidden part of the site. If we want to put the products first or our service first, social media does take time. And so it's really working out which one you're going to do first if you only have time for one and putting all of your effort into that before you just spread yourself too thin and limit the presence that you could have across one channel because you're trying to do three.
So if you're a startup, and say particularly a tech startup, where it may not always be entirely clear what your offer is if you're not sort of selling B2C, as it were, do you think that most companies have really got a handle on how to make this work for them? I mean, it's not as if it's something that's come up in the past, you know, in the past couple of years. It's been around long enough. But do you still see the same mistakes being made and a lack of detailed knowledge about how to make these platforms work?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the biggest thing I see is people get kind of drowned by all the different information out there. So often, you know, we meet a new client and they're looking for like a black and white method of doing digital marketing across the board. So did I do this wrong or right? And it's less about wrong and right and more about finding your voice and speaking authentically from it. So it's a different kind of approach to something which people are led to believe is a way of doing things, and they have to fit into a method in order to make something work, rather than saying, okay, this is who I am, this is what I do, now how can I take that voice and express it through social media and find the people who I believe most want to hear it. So I think that people get frustrated by digital marketing because they're led to believe by everything they see that this is the solution and the answer to them growing their business. And then nothing happens or things fail and they don't know why. And usually it comes down to not doing it long enough, you know, not allowing it to build organically, or trying to follow a method rather than focusing on what makes them different, what they bring to their audience that other people don't, and finding those points where we stand out. Because social media has lots of people talking at the same time.
I totally agree with that, Phil. Actually, one of the things that, you know, I work with a lot of tech businesses, and what we do is we're starting them off on social media from scratch. So they don't know anything about social media. And then I do exactly what you say, which is you just start off with one channel and then you move on to the others when you've got a handle on that first one. But one of the things I struggle with is getting people to understand that there's some things that you have to do for free. So you have to create content for free. You can't, you know, you can't sell every single thing that you have. So like you said, you know, they need to find a sort of niche or their social media personality, and they've got to put that out. And how do you convince businesses and especially tech businesses that, yeah, sometimes you just have to put some stuff out in a fun way and not expect people to immediately, you know, buy it. You've got to let it grow. So how do you get people to do that?
Case studies are always a great way of showing people how a certain type of business works. And so when we look at digital marketing in general, if we are offering a product that's available in many places and we're cheaper than everyone else, then it's actually possible to ask people to buy right away, because that price is the thing that is the call to action, really. But if we're selling something which is a brand new tech service, say, that no one's heard of, and maybe even does something that people don't yet know is truly beneficial to them, then we've got to tell that story. We've got to build up all of the reasons we created this tech app in the first place, and put them out there for people to find. Mm. So if you're a tech business, it's the same. It's talking about the problem you fix. And when you see people are engaged with your channel and the information you're putting out there, maybe that's the time to ask them to do a free trial. Tech is often trial driven, so to go from information to try it for free. Does it help you? And then at the end, we have that converted customer. But the flow is it's like any relationship. You know, you don't ask people to marry you on the first date. There's a whole load of things that need to happen between the two of you to get there. Mm. And so it's the same. It's the same. There's Bobby giving his opinion.
I think he agrees with you.
But because we know so much of this now is algorithm driven. I was even listening to an interview a couple of days ago that on TV commissioning now it's hard unless you can work out how you're going to pitch it to people who are already watching something who therefore might like this. It's quite difficult to get new things commissioned for TV because you know how do you pitch to people who aren't engaged? And we know that. Social media platforms and search engines change their algorithms a lot in ways that we may not necessarily always understand. So what is it that they want from us at the present time to push what people want to know about themselves without having to pay too much money, without having to do stuff that's going to disappear? What is it that works for them at the moment?
You're so right about algorithms. They've progressed so much in the last 5 years. And, you know, a lot of what we do at Positive Sparks is AI-driven. It's our kind of our version of what, our smaller version of what Google and Facebook and everyone else is doing. And so what we try and do is put a number of things out there. So if we think of a starting point, put a number of different bits of content out there or messages and track which gets the most engagement. So what algorithms really are ways of reverse engineering all of the things that happen and allowing the audience to tell us what they want. And this comes after what branding people would do and all these concepts that go into our brand, but really then taking those ideas, which are always great ideas, and testing them through algorithms and tracking, see what the audience best responds to. If we bounce off current events, that's even better because they are always trending on social media. So if we find the relevant items in the news or things that people are discussing that connect with what we offer, then that can really help too. And tracking all these things through and watching what moves for you organically, always the best thing to boost on any social media platform that has advertising potential is the post that's moving the best for you organically, because that already has an element of social proof from likes, clicks, comments. And we're pushing the most powerful piece, even if it's not what we feel internally is the strongest piece to lead a customer down a path.
I think one of the things I just want to add for our listeners is that, Phil, you're really experienced in this and are so successful with your Google ads that even Google's contacted you to find out what you do to make the algorithm work, right? Can you tell us more about that?
So, well, we've known Google a long time, so We have been running pay-per-click for a while, and we have a great rep there. We're actually on our third rep now, but we put enough through them for them to show us new things and to get our opinion on how those things work. And then if we do a campaign which works particularly well, they'll want to know what we did to make that happen. And that equally helps them give better advice to other people too in what they're doing. And, you know, as you watch, not just Google, but Bing and Facebook and LinkedIn to some extent now, all progress their advertising possibilities. They're learning all the time too. And so, you know, we see those relationships as really symbiotic. They can help us. We can tell them when something didn't work and did work. We can show them what's worked for us in the past. And even their own AI, they have a lot of dynamic campaigns now across the board, Google, Facebook, everywhere. The dynamic campaigns get better and better. So if we go back 4 years, they really, really failed. But, you know, we'll try and stick with things like that to watch them develop, to help Google better them, because the more data they have, the more successful they are. Same with Facebook. And communicate with them all the time. So there's a lot of conversations we have with Google and with third-party apps as well. You know, so if we find a bit of software that really helps us, the first thing I do is reach out to the guys building it or that founded it, because we want to learn more about it and we want to use our data to help them and help them develop it. And then we all develop together. And that's how we see all of those things. Google, third-party apps, every one of them.
I just want to talk about LinkedIn, because I feel like it's a very underused medium of social media. Do you agree? Yeah. And why do you think that is?
It's trying to find itself. I think LinkedIn is a platform. It's definitely getting there. It's become the Facebook for business in many ways. And lots of the things that Facebook did, LinkedIn have introduced.
Because I signed up to LinkedIn before I signed up to Facebook, whenever it was 10 years ago, 15 years.
There we go. So you've seen a very familiar view in the dashboard. It's definitely the best place for a B2B business to be. All of the people that you want to potentially communicate with are on there. Most business people have a LinkedIn profile. And it's the only place where we can target people from what they do, from their business, from where it's located, from the size of it. All these possibilities are only there in LinkedIn. Because they came to advertising quite late, then they are a little bit behind what we can do on Google and Facebook, but they're catching up. And they do have, you know, I think, a way of reaching out and building an audience that is business-focused, that is unique to them. It's completely unique. I think the only reason it feels underutilized is because it is a business platform and therefore different from the social media platforms. The others tend to be there for our passions and our family and our friends and all the things we kind of do outside of work, whereas LinkedIn has always been very work-focused.
It's very weird sometimes when you're on LinkedIn, actually, and somebody puts on something super personal and you think, actually, this is not the place for that. But usually when that happens, that gets a lot of hits. So it's quite confusing.
I agree with that. And I think LinkedIn has been both criticized and praised for that presence of people's personal lives. And especially in lockdown, there's been a lot of them, I think, where people have shown images of where they're working and sometimes given their experiences of how it's been tough or things are thankfully gone well for them or whatever. But I think fundamentally social media platforms are about people. And even though we're work focused on LinkedIn, we're still people. And that's why our personal profile always outperforms a page for a business, because a business is not a person. It only exists because of humanity. And it's the people on LinkedIn who connect and who chat and who get to know each other. So it's still people driven. And it's hard to ignore our personal life whenever we're speaking to other people, isn't it? So I think that's why they appear and why they're becoming part of LinkedIn. You're right, though. I see people out jogging on LinkedIn. And
yeah. She's like, what are you doing?
Videos of where they're going.
Yeah.
But I think that's all good. You know, it can be used as a communication point, and it can also be used as a marketing point as well. So, you know, I find that if on LinkedIn, really these days, I tend to reconnect with people I've not spoken with for 5 or 6 years. And it happens more there than it does on Facebook now.
And it's happening more now during lockdown, actually. I've connected with quite a few people that I haven't spoken to in 5, 10 years. And it's really, really nice, actually. It's really nice.
Ooh, that's right. You see, everyone's at home, getting bored, so they're online, on the phone. So platforms like LinkedIn and Facebook and Instagram are seeing more traffic than they've ever done right now.
Phil, I don't know if you can answer this question or not, but one of the concerns or criticisms that the Southwest often levels at itself in terms of the tech sector is that it doesn't do enough to promote itself or shout about the work that it's doing. And I think a lot of that can come down to the difficult geography, because it is such a big area. I mean, you know, the Tech Southwest itself goes up to Gloucester and across to Swindon and down to Southampton, and we sometimes feel that there isn't the identity that you can get from smaller areas with much more clearly defined clusters. How do you think that building an online presence and that kind of identity for a region can be done? How do people group together to try and tell the same kind of stories about where they live and work?
I guess your first thing is trying to bring people together with this notion of the Southwest. So I always remember when I used to kind of go and see my parents up in Cumbria, and I'm driving back to Cornwall, and psychologically, I felt like I was close back to home in Cornwall when I got to Bristol, but really I was halfway, because it was the same amount of time from Bristol to Cornwall as it was from Cumbria to Bristol. So it's a massive area. And so you've got people who feel like they're a long way from where I am in Truro, and you know, you guys are up in Devon, and you're right on the edge of Devon, so you're bordering on Somerset, and then, as you say, you have Bristol, which is its own big city. So the thing they all have in common is this tech kind of world that they're all working in. So maybe it begins with allowing them to meet each other and connecting the businesses which are doing similar things. I have a good friend here who's in healthcare tech. And so, you know, could he meet other people in the same industry across the Southwest? And is that how the area comes together? Because it is a big, big region, as you say. And the more, you know, going back to social media, the more that a web presence can help people meet each other, the better it'll do. Because that's what coming together means, isn't it? You know, we're coming together as people. So we have to meet each other as people. So I think that's what it has to focus on. Is allowing people to connect. And then when that website does go out to the wider world and wants to celebrate what's happening in the Southwest, that community that's been created will help that happen. So they'll share those posts and they'll comment that they've been involved in part of that, and all of that social connectivity will begin to work in the favour of the site.
Okay, I love talking to Phil. He's so great.
Yeah, I just learn so much every time, because in some ways the message is simple, but having that detailed understanding of actually what works and what doesn't work online, is the difference between success and failure for so many people and so many businesses.
And it's telling your story, but knowing how to tell your story and which parts of social media work best for different parts of that story.
And time is money, and you don't want to waste it doing things which no one's going to see or care about.
Absolutely. So that's it for the first Tribe Tech episode of 2021. See you all in a few weeks. We'll be going through the Tech Southwest survey, which so many of you contributed to. Thank you so much. And we'll find out what the leading trends and issues affecting the region are. So definitely tune in for that one.
Thank you so much for listening, as always, and please subscribe so you know when we're out next.
Bye. Bye.
A Tech Southwest podcast.